Right, so I'll call Mr. Lane, who is joining us via Zoom. I'm hoping that he can hear me. Here we go. Turn your mute off, Marcus. Does Marcus hear me if he could turn mute off? That is better. Thank you. So Marcus doesn't have a summary, so again, if you would just like to ask questions.
Mr. Lane, I'm the chair of the committee. I have only a relatively small number of questions, but first depress us and tell us what the temperature is like. Yes, you have depressed us.
Have you seen Scotland?
Yeah, but I'm not planning to go to Scotland. Mr. Lane, I just wanted to ask you about comparisons you're drawing in your evidence about golf courses in close proximity to airports. First question I had is, it seemed to me from the aerial photos that you're providing that a number, perhaps all of these golf courses were in urban areas. First of all, a point of disclosure, I have been to and played golf at Twin Waters Golf Club and hit numerous golf balls into various lakes.
Yes, I can tell you I have done the same thing there as well. So.
Adjusting the volume there. The question for you is, the impression I have from the aerial photographs you provided is that most, if not all, of these golf courses seem to be located in urban areas or have urban development around them, which leads me to wonder about how comparable they are to a resort course in a rural area. So that's my question. Are the examples that you provided comparable with Corbridge?
Well, I guess, sorry, I'm just trying to understand exactly what you're asking there. I suppose what I was looking at when we put these shots together was finding a number of courses that were within proximity of airports to show that they can coexist. I suppose, you know, you're correct. I'm just having a quick look through them now. And the majority of them are in residential areas, as you stated, but
the other example, or well, the other question that I had, is that Ms. Irving and her team are telling us that what they plan is an elite golf course, and obviously the involvement of the Greg Norman organisation would tell us that, even if they hadn't told us that. How many of the examples that you provided would meet that criteria?
There's quite a few there. Some of them are, I suppose, they're all different standards. Some of them are resort courses. They are top-tier courses in the areas that they are. For example, there was actually one of the courses, Sutira Harbour in Kota Kinabalu, I was actually involved in undertaking part of the design of that one on previous employment. That course is highly regarded, or was certainly highly regarded in the time. So, you know, as far as So as far as them being top tier courses, there's certainly a number of them that are particularly, like I said, the Kota Kinabalu. I think Twin Waters, whilst it's getting older, it was certainly a top tier course in its time as well. Going through the list of them here. And I guess looking at, and without knowing 100% what the courses are, but looking at some of the courses in America at Palm Beach and the likes of those courses would certainly be good quality courses as well too. So I would say that, you know, whilst we believe Corebridge is going to be something extremely special given the site and what we have to work with, these courses are certainly good quality courses within close proximity of airports.
And again, injecting a personal note, having stood on the fairways at Twin Waters and having had a wide body jet go over the top, it does tend to diminish one's golfing ambiance.
Yes, and it certainly does. In that proximity, that size of jet would certainly create, you know, distractions at times, but I guess looking at Corebridge and the way that the design would be laid out, and even looking at the preliminary routings and the way we've sort of worked on the site now, what we tend to do is try to minimise the amount of golf that will be in the line of the airport, and knowing that, I guess, at this stage and potentially down the track, the Wanaka Airport isn't going to have, you know, the number of the big jets and that sort of thing as well. So all those factors sort of go into the design of the course, not only just the number of holes that will be in the direct flight path, but also just the routing as well to sort of move you around a lot, get you out of that area as quick as possible to minimise any sort of distraction that you would have. So that'd be, I guess, the main thing that we would be working on to minimise that distraction. It would not have, like a lot of these other courses that are in those images, it's not going to be affected anywhere near, I don't believe, as much as those courses would be. And I know I've played those courses as well, Twin Waters and a couple of courses down in Sydney, and you certainly see a plane go over. They're overhead for 20 or 30 seconds. It's in my honest opinion, less of a distraction than the actual, you know, some of the trouble you get into on a golf course that tends to take your mind off an aeroplane going overhead. So,
I wasn't so much thinking about the distraction as the lack of consistency with the image of the resort. Take your point about the fact you're not going to get intercontinental wide body jets going out of Wanaka, not anytime soon. But the open question is, if the operation is projecting itself as an elite course to seriously wealthy golf tourists is being located under a flight path consistent with that?
I think the quality of the golf course will outweigh the impact of that compared to looking at other projects that I've been involved with and worked with where you don't get all the boxes ticked like you get with a Corbridge site. So, you know, I think it greatly outweighs the fact that you're going to have, you know, potentially the odd plane flying overhead over two or three of the golf holes. I think that the site itself and how it's going to lend itself to the design will outweigh that greatly and become a top-tier golf course.
Thank you, Mr. Lane. That's what I had. Anything
from
my colleagues?
Nothing from me, thank you.
Just one, if I may, it's just a question that you may or may not be able to answer, but how many marquee courses is too many?
Sorry, I missed part of that one. What was that again?
Sorry, just wondering.
So the question was one of demand. How many elite courses is too many in an area?
Well, I think it's they add to each other. To have set up a course, particularly in Wanaka, starts to create a trail of top 10 courses. Obviously, you've got courses down south near Queenstown, and then course up in Christchurch, and then further up on the North Island, you know, a few more. But I think, you know, certainly at this stage, and particularly in that area, I don't think there's an over market of top tier courses at all. And I think adding a potential course in Wanaka there would add to the the attraction of getting down there and playing the courses.
That's all we have, Mr. Lane. Thank you for zooming in. Appreciate your time. Hope you have a nice day.
Certainly. All right. Thank you.
I'm just wondering, we've got Mr. Brandyburg online, and he, of course, is also golf-related. And so I'm wondering if we stick with the theme. Good one. So I think Ryan's just turned off mute. So he's been sitting there. So I think are you happy with that, Pete?
Yeah.
So I'll leave you to ask any questions of Mr. Brandyburg.
Morning.
Thank you, Mr. Bean, Mr. Brandenburg. The question I have for you is that I can recall seeing you present almost the identical evidence that you're giving for Corbridge for a previous golf proposal, Hogan's Gully in Queenstown, and so I infer that part of your role is to make the case to expand the network of high-quality golfing offerings around the country. Is my understanding correct?
Good morning. Yes, it is correct. I mean, we absolutely advocate for more quality golf that not only draws international visitors but has a domestic and a short-haul appeal as well. So, you know, the data is very similar, especially being in the same region, but the international numbers would also be quite similar. So I would advocate for, if we could double the existing marquee courses in the region, I would be thrilled, and I'd love to see even more within a drive of the region.
and that may answer the question you already, if you've been sitting listening to our discussion with Mr. Lane, we asked him how many elite courses is too many. Of course, we have the three existing ones. We also have a consented golf course resort at Parkins Bay, which I understood, if it, assuming it proceeds, is planning on presenting an elite course. What is saturation?
Well, I mean, right now, obviously, I'm familiar with the Parkins Bay project as well. You know, what we've seen, Queenstown's three marquee courses have accounted for about 51% of all the marquee course rounds played in New Zealand between kind of 2014 and 2018. What that's done is put a tremendous amount of pressure on that destination. You know, what we would define as a golf destination would be three or more courses within a short drive of each other. So, you know, if you would ask Kinloch and Wairaki and Taupo, I don't think they would say a third course would be a threat. They'd say a third course would be a blessing. My years at Kari Cliffs and Cape Kidnappers, I would have begged for another marquee golf course to be built in the Hawke's Bay or up in the Bay of Islands. So I think, you know, the nature of great golf alongside each other makes it more of a draw card. I would look at it and say, look, the Hills have seen tremendous pressure for visitor play. Millbrook's seen tremendous pressure. Jack's Point's seen tremendous pressure. What that's done is driven prices up and also limited access. So what we risk if we don't add more golf is actually losing the international appeal that we have, not gaining more. You know, I think golfers are a bit different as well, where golfers like to seek out new projects. You know, there are people that, you know, seek out the newest golf courses, the, you know, play the World Top 100 lists, you know, are seeking out, especially golf courses designed by, you know, world-class architects like Norman. You know, their firm is obviously renowned for what they've done. So there's no concern from my side that adding a Norman-designed golf course in Wanaka would do anything but lift our profile internationally.
Can you just clarify that statistic you gave me, the... that you said 50% of, or 51% of demand is going through Queenstown. Is that, was that
correct?
The
so we started with 12 marquee courses when we wrote the strategy. We've added two more in Auckland since then. So we have four marquee courses on the South Island, and we have 10 on the North Island. Yet those four on the South Island, primarily driven by the three in Queenstown, Clearwater, and Christchurch being the fourth, which is actually one of our lowest volume marquee courses at Clearwater. So Jack's Point, the Hills, and Millbrook are playing 50% of our inbound golf rounds. A lot of that is Australia, although they have a growing profile in throughout Asia, especially in China and Japan, and with the U.S. market now as well. And the New Zealand Open has done a lot to help that. You know, getting that region broadcast on television has been quite powerful. What we're seeing, though, is the repeat market, the Australian market especially. You know, they've come for several years, they've played all three of those, and now they're starting to venture further afield. And that's benefiting the likes of Cromwell, it's benefiting Val McEwen in Otago, or in Dunedin, it's benefiting Chisholm in Dunedin, to a lesser extent, a bit of Invercargill, but Wanaka does seem to be missing out. Wanaka Golf Club, at this stage, I know there's some discussion about some renovation work there, just is not ticking the box for the international visitor. Wonderful domestic product, wonderful local amenity, but it's not bringing in an international visitor at this stage. So really that traffic from international visitors is not making its way to Wanaka at the moment.
And can you answer also for me, what is the current status of Hogan's Gully? Is it still... being pushed, or have the owners looking for other ideas?
No, there's an ongoing discussion with council at the moment through a mediation process. So I think, I mean, if, in a perfect world, if we could add Hogan's Gully and Corbridge and get you know, the Glen Dubé, Parkins Bay project up and running, I mean, six world-class golf courses within kind of a 60 to 90 minute drive of each other would be a dream come true from my perspective of promoting New Zealand as an international golf destination. I mean, right now in Da Nang alone, you have more than double that amount of courses under construction, let alone what their existing inventory is. You look at the British Isles and the huge density of superb golf within a short drive of each other, which I would mention, based on your previous question to Fraser, St. Andrews, you know, probably the most famous golf course in the world, the old course, sits within, you know, a few kilometers of an RAF base. So just to kind of bring that comment up since I can slide it in there. I'm a huge believer in adding more quality. I'm not necessarily a big believer in just adding more quantity. I think it has to be golf that appeals to an international visitor.
So you don't think Tara's Golf Club is really going to cut it?
Now, with that said, I actually like Terrace quite a bit. The Shrek Museum is quite cool right there. But we actually have started telling the story of, so we have our marquee courses. We have our New Zealand Experience courses. We've picked five country courses that we've started to kind of tease out to the international market, and that was actually going quite well pre-COVID. Terrace was one of those. Roxborough was one of those. And oddly enough, almost the wealthier the individual, the more they love those rustic, unique experiences. Now, they're not going to come to New Zealand and play 10 of them, but if they're coming to New Zealand to play 10 rounds of golf, many of them love the opportunity to get to a real, authentic country course. I took Golf Digest China to a golf course called Te Pahui on the Napier-Taupo Road. I mean, you drive past it at 100K an hour, and they said, we thought these were just a myth. They said, we've heard about them, but nobody ever talks about them, they're never in magazines. But there is some appeal there, but obviously people aren't going to travel long haul to play Terrace. No, but they very well may go there as a novelty afternoon.
I just cannot understand that. anyone else?
Brendan? No, it's good. Thank you.
I have an airport.
Just there is going to be, well, potentially an airport, but the only question I've got, Mr. Vandenberg, was the... I think Corbridge is suggesting 27 holes. I was just wondering on your views on 18, 27, or 36 in terms of the number of holes and a marquee course.
Oh, I mean, I think, you know, Millbrook going to the first true 36-hole resort in the country is great. I mean, that added capacity is something that, again, we lack in the region. Surely from a commercial perspective, you know, the 27 holes allows you to what we would call triple tee, so you could essentially tee off people from holes 1, 10, and 19, essentially. So that gives them some more flexibility. It allows them to also be a bit more flexible with how they manage on-site, kind of short stay slash resort play, if you want to call it that, potentially member play, green fee play from visitors, and then a local component as well. So, to me, that adds a lot of flexibility. It does add cost, which is obviously a choice that they're going to make. But I certainly see that as a benefit.
And just to add to your comment about the St. Andrews and RAF base, just about the whole of Scotland is in close proximity to an RAF base, unfortunately.
That's probably true. Well, okay, Troon and Prestwick's another good example. So Troon sits right next to Glasgow Prestwick. That's a real airport, not an RAF, I believe.
Yeah. Thank you. That's all.
Well, I think we're good.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Brandenburg. All right. Mr. Marshall.
Thanks very much for the opportunity and thanks for the comment of my enthusiasm at the farm, because I was actually running at about 5%.
It was a cold day.
It was a cold day, yeah. I guess the purpose of me asking to talk is the visionary process of how we do it between Lloyd and I, and what we've talked about for many years about Corbridge. And really want to express, you know, Lloyd and I are getting to the crusty end of our life, and you look at what you can actually leave behind as opposed to what you've actually done in the past. So really in New Zealand do we get a chance to build iconic things that are just fantastic. And at times, I think New Zealand at the moment aspires to mediocrity. And we are not building stuff that is just fantastic to go and look forward to. That's my personal view. In developing the Corbis proposal, there's always been the intention of developing not only a world-class facility in its own right, but a development that showcases technological innovations not seen in New Zealand, that will improve sustainability, and that's a word that is kind of used, and I get the green paint thing. But it's something I think we can truly do in there, and I've done a lot of research on how we can do that as well. Mitigate the environmental disruption, because we've got the scale to do that, and showcase what spectacular excellence we can look like. The Upper Clutha, with all the reasons that we all want to live here, and I've been here for 20 years, Lloyd's been here for 2 years longer than me, I've just been picking up the scrapings after he got here to a large degree. So what we can do is also look at how we can actually attract sort of the digital innovations that are available in the world today. We've already socialised with our neighbours, the Wanaka Airport, ways for us to integrate together. I've suggested to them we move our boundaries, and I've talked about what I've called in loose terms an e-way into town. We've talked about this a lot around our community. Unfortunately, it doesn't fit with NCTA's philosophy sometimes, but we've talked about how we can actually mitigate getting to town off track, off road. And an e-way to me is a word I use for anything from an electric skateboard wheel up to a mountain bike into town from the airport zone, if you wanted to call it that, and Corbridge being pathway to that. A smart way of doing things. If we're going to have people wanting to get to town, why would we want to stick them in cars and buses and so on and so forth? Let's make it easier for them. We're very close to town. We can, across the property, create something that's really sustainable. And what we've demonstrated is a willingness to do this. You know, we're one of the first people in the Upper Clutha. We already use battery remote mowers around the property. You know, and I look at how much time and life that saved us, and we've been using those for nearly 3 years now. I do get abused by the maintenance guys because I make them work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I don't give them holidays. But so I pulled out the hours on one of our remote mowers the other day, and he's done 5,000 hours without a complaint. The development's always been people-centric. Focus has been given to what people will experience and how. How people will interact with the environment, how people will be transported and move around the property, and how people will be accommodated as either guests or workers. And I enhance that by saying we're not trying to build the Truman Show here. With at least 12 kilometres of internal tracking, what's wrong with a worker getting out to be able to go and walk, run, mountain bike around the property before they start their day? I think it's fantastic. I think it's the way we are livable these days. We want to be a place where you can live and recreate as well, as opposed to drive out of your property, out of your Kiwi built house in Northlake. You can actually experience the lifestyle that you actually work within as well, not just work in it. What we want to create within Corbridge is a development with a massive amount of experiential attraction that is a place that people want to visit. And it's polar opposite to, I guess, what is built today out in the marketplace. The developers these days will try and take everything down to the minimalistic size. 300 metres, pass the toothpaste, open the window each. You know, I mean, it's really not, I don't think, how we want to live as Kiwis going forward. So why would we do that here? Why would we expect our visitors to experience that sort of thing? The other thing I talk about is legacy. I've had a couple of opportunities in my life to leave a legacy behind in businesses we've had. And I guess at the moment, Callum, you know about it, but opposite the marina right now, there's an apartment complex being built. People don't know that that's us. And I think if you look at the quality and structure of how that's been put up, it's actually going to be a true part of this town going forward. and it's been the biggest development done in this town and possibly in the Upper Clutha for quite some time. The opportunity to create a project for 2050. I'm a techo guy, I love technology. The opportunity to remove petrochemical devices off the property, the opportunity to actually put in water, waste systems, etc., that actually really are the legacy of our life cycle of where we're going. And I think Mr. Boddy might talk about that a little bit later on, about our views and visions on that. But we have an opportunity to create something that's different. We have an opportunity to create something that's actually truly magnificent. And I think we should do that. When we talk about workers, and that's been talked about before, Jason did use the term, you know, a single man's accommodation like was used at Tauranga, for example, when the Italians dug the tunnels up there. Why would we expect our people to live like that? Why would we expect workers to live like that? We're talking about a light touch structure on the land. We talk about not crushing the land. We talk about kiss it with kindness. That's our view. That's how we want to build this. You'll hear other people talk about a product. I don't call it landscaping, I call it kindscaping. Softscape. Make it gentle. We don't need to excavate the place. We don't need to do a hikawai and dig the place out and chuck it in the Clutha. We've got the contour. The golf guys didn't talk so much about the fact that the Greg Norman guys have said to us, it is the best physical structure they've ever seen. We go down to about 1.8 metres of topsoil on that place. Why would I rip all that up? That's why the structure of this place is so perfect for what we're trying to do. In summary, Corbridge's proposal is not just another hotel or golf course development. It's far greater than that. We aspire to push the boundaries of design, innovation, and environmental stewardship to be an icon of New Zealand. We want to set a bar high and a beacon that can be developed. If we have the passion and the courage to aspire to world-class and world leaders and not succumb to mediocrity, as I think so many have done before us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall. Trying to think, you obviously have a vision. Do you think that vision is communicated through the planning documents that Mr. Curley and Mr. Edgar are going to talk to us about?
I will have to say this. I'm probably telling you my vision, but as professionals and planners, and I think we've assembled the best crew that we can find in this whole district to actually represent us. And I take words from, as you saw me yesterday in the hearing with Mr. Burden, Richard Burden, that I'm sure, and to take Mr. McLeod's statement before, they would not be leading us down a rabbit hole that wasn't acceptable to the market. I've got trust and faith in everything that has been said, and I'm probably getting my vision interpreted and speak that is relevant to the way these proceedings go ahead, as opposed to the passion that can't be said on paper.
That's the reason I asked you that question, is to wind them up so they're ready for the answer.
They get rebriefed as we move forward.
Commissioner Dawson, any questions from Mr. Martin?
No,
just irrespective of how this rises or falls, I do admire and love your passion. Thank you.
Mr. Hill?
Nothing, thank you. It's clear. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much,
Mr.
Marshall.
Right, I think we will move on to Mr. Falconer.
Okay. too.
Great.
About Corbridge. So you've read my evidence. I'm happy to take questions.
Mr. Dawson.
All right. What I started asking this question before. What is being put to us here in terms of the workers' accommodation? Is a concept of a small livable community. I think you've talked about it as being a worker village, a living environment. I think Mr. Marshall just talked about people being able to work, live, and recreate all on the same site. I mean, all of which are very admirable qualities in urban design terms. But on the other side of it, we have the sort of direction and the policy direction in the plan for people to live and to a certain extent work and recreate and shop and all those things in towns where the commercial facilities are, the public facilities, the recreation, the sports facilities, the schools, the entertainment. All those places are focused in towns. We're not using too much space. We're getting people close so they don't have to commute too far. So there's this sort of tension between one set of sustainable urban design principles or sustainable principles for living and working and the principles that are coming through for this village, for the workers. And how do you reconcile those? Where do you draw the line between everybody in living in little, tiny, lovely little settlements all throughout the rural area versus the whole let's focus on the towns, which does come through in the policy direction?
Yeah. I think we need to recognise that worker accommodation has been an integral element of our settlement pattern throughout New Zealand, and it's just not restricted to towns. We've seen purpose-built worker accommodation for mining projects, for highway projects, hydro projects throughout our history, but they haven't been particularly livable, and I think that's the whole...
But they're also often remote.
At times, yes, at times, but I think there has been a transition in... the range of workers and the type of work. I think we're seeing a transition to work that is service orientated, and particularly with Corbridge, we're looking at worker accommodation that will service the various activities happening on the property, whether it's in hospitality, whether it's in golf course maintenance, and that. So it is relevant to the site's function. I think that's the purpose. But if those workers were located in town, they would have to travel out every day, and that would, I mean, in terms of efficiency and effects, and that wouldn't be as optimal.
So when you look at the units that are proposed, I mean, they're not the single man's quarters of the past or even the one-bedroom studio apartments of the present. Those workers may well have families, partners and children. Those people will be travelling back and forth if they're not all required to stay on site or work on site. People don't live in isolation from their wider families or in terms of creating that whole less efficient, supposedly unsustainable movement of people back and forth towns and all the facilities and services that towns provide.
Yeah, I think you used the word livable before in terms of the worker accommodation. I think that's exactly right. That's where we're trying to go. And there will be a range of people from, you know, typically the single male through to couples to perhaps families. And I think that's a really healthy thing. And it, we don't necessarily need to assume that that increases the amount of travel from those families or those couples into town. But they could all be working on the
but
site.
But they won't. I mean, people don't just work. They do other things in their lives. They don't just work and go for a morning walk around the golf course. I mean, children go to school. People need to shop. People play in sports teams. People go to the movies, or you know, people live their lives. And I and when you've got a community without any of those facilities there, isn't that the anathema of community building?
No, I mean, I think your questions are pertaining to you know, the efficiency of settlement patterns. And if we look at what's happening at the moment with the Upper Clutha area, we're seeing polycentric or multi-centric pattern evolving. Cadrona, Luggett, Hawera particularly at the moment, and Wanaka. You'd say Wanaka is actually a series of centres, you know, Peninsula Bay, Northlake, etc. So, and that's a, I mean, that's a relatively old and established network of settlements. And there are some real pluses for that settlement pattern because it allows for a variety of different functions and uses in those particular centres, and it also can touch the supporting landscape and its functions quite lightly. It's the basis of the Garden City concept, which Ebenezer Howard developed in the late 19th century.
So do you see this as another little settlement as part of that broader settlement pattern in the Upper Clutha Basin?
It's a type of settlement, a type of activity use, and that it's condensing a number of uses and activities onto a site.
But you're not. Are you expecting it to, in time, have a convenience store, some daycare, so, you know, the sort of things that you might find in a small settlement? I mean, the other settlements you talk to are all growing to the stage where they've got schools, have got the getting, or have got commercial premises, sports fields, all those things. This isn't intended to be like that, is it?
No, I don't think it is.
But would you see it as potentially growing to that in time if it's part of that pattern of settlement in the district, in the Upper Clutha?
No, I don't think it's a new town or a new suburb. It is what it is. It's a multi-purpose development. It's got hospitality, recreation, and some residential.
Yeah, I'm just talking about the workers' accommodation.
So the workers' accommodation, I think, is an integral element. It has a inherently a transient or a temporary or element to it, which might relate to the time of year or particular projects, like you mentioned earlier, construction. They might feature earlier on. I think potentially it could also look at, you know, the seasonal harvesting of grapes and all that happen. So it is less permanent, I guess.
Okay, yeah, all right.
Yeah.
So you do see it as being more of a people come, they might work there for a while, even if it's a few years, and then move out. I mean, it's very much tied to the work.
I think, as was mentioned earlier by one of the presenters, it could also be the manager of the hotel or the golf course, that him and his family
might be there longer too.
Yeah. I think that's healthy to accommodate for that full range, and also for the health of the worker village itself, and there'll be a range of people there. It just won't be one type doing one thing.
No, no. Yeah. All right, thank you.
Mm. Thank you for your evidence. And I'm kind of interested in if you set aside the, let's call it the legality, the appropriateness of the workers' accommodation, in terms of, and you mentioned it, alluded to that a historic, it's been part of a settlement pattern that we've had. How do you, as an urban designer, see that pattern evolving into the future? Using this as an example, is this something that, because there's a lot of Mr. Marshall's vision being, you know, leaving something behind that's an exemplar. How do you see workers' accommodation moving into the future, or a concept of?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think this is an innovative scheme that responds to the current and very dynamic demands on the landscape in the Upper Clutha area and wider. As I think somebody said, 97% of Queenstown Lakes area is an outstanding natural landscape. But it's one of the highest growth, population growth areas in the whole country. And it seems almost insatiable, the demand for people to live in this outstanding landscape. So how do we accommodate them without destroying the landscape? And visitor accommodation, they need people to clean the rooms, to work in the bars and change the sheets and all that. And we've seen this real issue in the servicing of Queenstown and its accommodation. So often the worker accommodation has become as a latter day afterthought. So we're looking at in the planning of Corbridge of this being an integral element right up front, and it being visionary in an innovative way and being very livable. So I'm hoping that this can go forward as I think the term has been used earlier, as an exemplar, a benchmark that sets a new precedent for further development in the area. And we know there's a lot of development going on and will continue into the future.
And just in terms of like in urban design speak, ribbon development, urban sprawl, how do you see this? Is this an example of sprawl?
No, I mean, when you look at Queenstown, I mean, Queenstown has effectively taken the same path. If you look at Jack's Point, Millbrook, I wouldn't say Lake Hayes, but you know, those developments are essentially these little centres that are further distributing the population out, but within a defined growth boundary. But there's green belts areas between them. Corbridge is not that far from the outskirts of what is existing as a township of Wanaka, and you look at the airport as a transportation hub. It is strategically located, so I think it fits within that overall model that's been evolving and adopted within the Queenstown Lakes area. It brings it into Wanaka.
And finally, just a question of the juxtaposition, as I see it, between the five-star plus resort and the workers' accommodation. Blanket Bay, for example, installed a second lift so that the workers and the residents wouldn't actually mix. How do you see that juxtaposition playing out from an urban design perspective, given that I'm living there, I'm working in the kitchen, and I want to go for a walk around? Is that a conflict, or is that resolvable?
think that's you've identified another area that needs work, and I think the old split dichotomy between workers and visitors has not produced healthy long-term communities. There's always been tension there, so I think the work accommodation is founded on a spacious, low density, but private arrangement which gives access to the entire site, and we we've talked about laneways and walking and bike trails that distribute right across the extensive site. Now it's about 300 hectares. And the workers will have full access to that. And I think for workers to have a sense of ownership and access to a site like this will be a positive thing.
Final, because I've said a final a couple of times. The sustainability and the green paint discussion that I've mentioned to a few people, again, through an urban design lens, I'm interested in, I mean, obviously this is just lines on a paper, but this versus, in comparison to examples you've seen of similar proposals. Just testing it.
I was going to kind of react to that, saying that I don't actually believe in sustainability. I think, and that's quite a confrontational statement. So I'll maybe just park that thing there, because it is a concept that's been proposed, and 1992, the Rio Earth Summit. It's been around for a long time. We haven't seen a lot of progress using that worldwide. I think we've got to look for other alternatives, and we've got to look locally. This whole site development is founded on Peter's vision of touching the land lightly, and I think that is a fundamental starting point for working with the land in a way that doesn't cause a lot of effects, and maybe can perhaps go along the regenerative model line, which is one that is now being picked up more perhaps than the term sustainable. Actually helps regenerate the landscape, the health of the landscape, retains the soil, the water flow, but also brings in greater biodiversity and also then working into the social and economic functions of what's going to be happening on that site, working through those. I think it's a comprehensive and integrated approach that will yield a development that doesn't need a lot of inputs or has lesser inputs than others. And again, sets another exemplar benchmark. It's a challenge.
One final, because I've done a final a couple of times.
I think I heard you say final
just
several times, Commissioner.
I love the term regeneration because it's something that doesn't get said often enough, and the final question is, how do you balance a regenerative concept and golf tourism and people flying in?
So I don't play golf, and I don't understand it, why people walk around chasing a little ball with funny sticks.
Haven't lived until you've hit a golf ball in the lake. Or played golf next to an RAF base.
But I get a sense that it's a very persuasive and addictive recreational pursuit that gets people outside, it gets them social, and it gets them actively recreating, which is a healthy thing. I watch and read about many resort developments, and golf courses are often an integral part of them. There has been a shift, a transition with the design of golf courses to be ecologically based, whether it's creating wetlands or wastewater systems, using native plants, working with the local topography, using less imported grasses, using less pesticides and fertilisers. So there has been a shift to integrate golf courses into what is basically a landscape type, a pastoral type of landscape, but with probably less inputs. So I think the golf course that has been conceptually included in this is fits well with that overall landscape.
No,
more questions?
I can give one.
Okay.
Restrain the commissioner's enthusiasm. Thank you very much, Mr. Fulton. Did you have anything?
No, thank you.
Oh, sorry. Wonderful. Worked along the same. Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate your input.
Thank you.
I should ask, how are we tracking, given that we're in our 3 hours in?
Well, we're tracking better than I had anticipated, I have to say. So, I was intending to call Mr. Botting now to deal with the infrastructure issues.
Right. Oh, and what's the update on Mr. Colgrave's state of health?
Well, he's sitting online listening to us, so he will be joining us after lunch, was my plan. Yeah.
All good.
Morning, or should I say almost afternoon, actually, the time.
2 minutes past 12.
Right, I'll just read through a few points in regards to Mr. Powell's evidence that he provided as rebuttal evidence, and then I can take questions, if that's right. So, in terms of development numbers or units, we're at the point where we're not really sure, obviously, how many units are going to be involved in Corbridge. So when I looked at the servicing of it, I didn't really consider those as important at this stage. In my experience, though, once detailed modelling has been completed, if we look into connect to council services, there's usually two outcomes. The first outcome is that the development can be serviced by existing infrastructure, albeit maybe with some minor upgrades, or that the development size may be limited until such time as council services are upgraded to cope with the increased demand. And the funding of these upgrades is obviously covered by development contributions. So in my view, the second outcome does not mean that the land cannot be zoned, but it's more a matter of timing when the development can proceed. Now, given the lead-in times associated with large developments, there's usually sufficient time for council to factor in how additional demand can be accommodated into its network. And that includes, obviously, the allocation of funds and scheduling when the work is to be completed. Talking with the developers or the owners of Corbridge, the demand would be, if they were to start tomorrow, to develop a golf course, would be likely at least 3 years away before that demand would occur if we were going to connect to council's network. Now, Mr. Powell mentioned something about the scale of the development as such that it would be required to be connected to council services. Now, given that the development or the location of the land is outside any currently serviced council network, I can't actually find any requirement in the district plan or the code of practice around scale when development has to be connected. Certainly requirements for it to be serviced. There is reference or rule in the subdivision chapter that where there is a water network available, development has to connect, but where it's not available, which I would take to mean it's not physically near the site or has capacity, that it has to still provide water, which would be by means of a private scheme. I also looked at examples of other local developments that are outside council serviced area. They include a large number of units that are serviced by private infrastructure. Now, a good example is Jack's Point. It has private wastewater disposal. It also has a private water scheme that's owned and operated by the Residents Association for Jack's Point. Now, I've talked to Interflow Technologies, who are a wastewater company that manages Jack's Point, and have been told that can service or accommodate current capacity for about 750 lots at the moment. And the wastewater can be scaled up depending on as demand increases. Another good example locally of a not quite a private wastewater network is the Glendu Bay Campground. It's obviously council owned but leased to a private company. That has capacity at the moment for the equivalent of about 150 to 200 units, and it's of course located in a fairly sensitive area, being quite close to the lake. For potable water supply, Corbridge already has ample water via three bores. I've reviewed two of the bore permits. The capacity available out of the two main bores would allow, based on council's 2,100 litres per unit per day, potential total number of units of over 1,200. So there is sufficient water there from the existing corporate private bores to cover a significant number of units. There's also a supply of water from the Luggett Creek irrigation scheme, which would be used for obviously for irrigation of the golf course and wider planting areas around the site. So it's my opinion that the servicing of the site is therefore immediately available or achievable by private infrastructure. There are options, depending on what's happening with council's network, for connection to be made at a future point once capacity is available. But development could proceed off its own back with private systems. And lastly, what needs to be really thought about is the vision for Corbridge as a sustainable development, and looking at innovative technologies, water reuse, separating grey water, black water, real opportunities to create, as Peter would say, a vision for sustainability and how the site operates and deals with its effects. So open to any questions. Or just for background, I was also involved in the original consent, so know the site quite well in terms of...
When you say original consent, do you mean the 35
Oh, the 35 one, yes.
Soon, you're talking on-site wastewater. You're talking about a private, centralised wastewater treatment area.
Mm-hmm.
Where would it be?
Well, there's opportunities around the site to perhaps have one centrally located system in some of the open space areas. There's quite a, I think the activity areas, let's check. Got open space activity areas AA6 and AA7. Obviously, we want to limit the cost to convey wastewater around the site. The key things we have to ensure is that the treatment is more than 50 metres away from a water body or a water bore. So it would likely be located in the area between AA1 and AA8, which is roughly in the middle of the site. Talking with
basically north of the reservoir.
So either in that area there or potentially over here. Now, talking with Inovo in a flow, we could look at even two or three systems. It really depends on the detailed design as to what that looks like. Jack's Point, for example, utilises three treatment plants spaced throughout its development. What could influence the design could be if it was to be connected to council's network at a future stage, it would be probably appropriate to have it come to one point so that then you could then decommission the plant and install one pump station to take it through to Project Pure. So.
And what sort of building would be required? How big?
Well, a good example for looking at more locally is the Glendu Bay campground. Now, Inoflow have produced a case study for that. It's very discreet. The units that are supplied take up a space of 500 square metres, but the majority of it is below ground. And then, obviously, from the treatment, the second and third stage treatment, it's dispersal to ground, which takes up another, in terms of area, underground, approximately 3,000 square metres. But above ground, really just a small plant for perhaps power, and depends on whether or not you have the need for chlorination of the water before you send it for dispersal. I can provide you the case study for Glendu Bay. I mean, it's a perfect example of a need for a discrete system that doesn't, isn't intrusive into the camp users.
I suppose this is where the total, what sort of total demand? You said Glendu Bay was 150 to 200 units.
Mm-hmm.
If using the same point of comparison, how many units are you talking about for in terms of the Corbridge concept as it's been presented to us?
Well, the best example for to look at the Jack's Point one, which has three of these units or treatment plants spaced throughout its development. The total size requirement for that, you could scale, of course it depends on the number of units, be four times the size of the Glendu Bay campground.
So 2,000 square metres.
Yeah. Well, it depends, the units, I'd have to check further with Inoflow about the actual size, but based on the size of Glendu Bay servicing, up to 200, if we're looking at, say 800 units, I would assume it'd be four times the size. But I mean, that's detailed design. The advantage with Corbridge is that, given its size, it's 320 hectares, and a significant amount of that is going to be open space. We've got opportunities to obviously dispose of our wastewater within quite a large area of the site.
The reason I'm asking you is, next question I'm going to ask Mr. Kirby is where that's provided for in the structure plan and what it says.
Right.
So hence I want to know what I'm asking him. So you're talking four units the size of Glendu Bay.
Yeah.
Do they need to be separated? Could they be right next to each other?
Oh, the ones at Glendu Bay, I mean, they're underground units that are interconnected. They're clustered in a relatively small area, and then the disposal comes obviously out underground, or in terms of the disposal of the water to ground once it's been treated. They could be separated, but then you'd probably be best to then look at two or three units around the site. I mean, it depends where you're going to have your greatest demand as to where you'd want to put your wastewater, and the efficiencies of conveying it. It's sort of, you've got to weigh up the cost of length of pipes, and but really the location for it in the open space areas is obviously the logical location. Really the detailed design around would need to be obviously worked through once we know the number of units that we're having to cater for.
But basically your position is the so much land.
Yeah, so many options.
There's no doubt you find space and
yes.
And both for any central plant and for a disposal field.
Correct, yeah.
Mr. Hill?
Just one question, again, in going to Mr. Powell's rebuttal evidence, where he, as you quite correctly pointed out, he says that it would require connection, and then, and because of that, he's discounted looking at your on-site. Has there been any further conversation with Mr. Powell? I mean, he seems to have a view that connection is required. You're saying it could be done on-site.
Yeah, I had a discussion with Richard about it, and looked at what is required under the Local Government Act in terms of when a service is close to a site. And yeah, I think it's under section 459 in terms of when council can make a private owner connect, and the service has to be within 30 metres of the site or boundary. But the building also has to be within 60 metres. So Corbridge, even though it might have the wastewater coming past the pumping main from town, the actual development itself is, you know, several hundred metres within the site, so it's not readily available.
So there's clearly a legal component to that. So
yes, I think so. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So you've had the conversation.
He wasn't sure as well. He was a wee bit vague on it, to be honest. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Dawson.
Presumably, both the wastewater and the water supply would all need regional council consent.
Correct.
So the water supply, the bores that are there at the moment, you say there are existing bores.
Yep, yes.
What do they have consents for at the moment?
I've got copies of that I can provide you.
Tell me what use the consents are for. Is it for
irrigation
and stock water or something
and,
like that?
No, and it also includes residential water can be taken at any time as well.
For the 34 units? Or?
No, just in general. It doesn't actually specify
it
that
say
the residential
what the
is limited. Yeah.
And is there a capacity, flow limit?
Yes, there is, yep. It's
broken down
into litres.
Not the capacity of the bore, but the consent.
The annual capacities?
Well, whatever it says, a flow or an annual capacity.
Well, let me just find the... Well, I've got the combined total in my notes here. Just give me a minute.
So are you saying that the existing bores have consent for residential use that is sufficient to provide greater than 1,200 units, I think you said?
So I've got a diagram in my evidence there that shows the location of the bores. So bores 1 and 2 have water permits that allow an extraction of up to the combined, the two of them, 900... and 56,000 cubic metres per year, and that can be used for irrigation or at any stage used for residential purposes.
And how much do 1,200 units need?
Well, I've simply taken the 956 and divided it by the code of practice requirement for 2.1 cubic metres per day to come up with that approximate 1,200 theoretical number. Just based on the permitted water take that they have at the moment. So.
And you're saying those consents could just be switched over to providing residential use without any change to the consents?
I'd have to check further with ORC, but it includes that they can be used for residential purposes at any time.
Okay. Presumably the Luggett irrigation scheme is irrigation.
Yes, correct.
And it could be used maybe if the golf course is to be irrigated, possibly, but not necessarily switched over to supply 1,200 units of residential.
Yeah, that might be a wee bit pushing it for that, in terms of whether or not that's a secure water source. There has been talk about piping it from the...
And it must be seasonal.
Well, Luggett Creek flows year-round. I know a lot of the existing farmers use it for... obviously irrigation, but also for domestic use further up the scheme, but that's obviously limited to only a handful of users. Something like 1,200, I wouldn't be advocating that would use that water from the Luggett scheme.
I can't imagine. There might be some other people that have something to say about that. I mean, you say you haven't worked out how many units there might be in the zone provisions, and you haven't done any modelling.
No.
And I suppose this question is as much for the planners as you, but I'm saying it now so they can hear me. The way the zone is being sought, many of the units would be permitted. Mm-hmm. The visitor accommodation units would be permitted. Residential would be permitted. There might be a subdivision involved for the residential, but not necessarily for anything else. The hotel, the buildings might require consent, but that's really about their design. And the submission's asking for a zone that provides for a lot of things as permitted activities. It's not like a subdivision that's still got to come along and all the detail worked out then. But so we're reliant on you just telling us it'll be fine. For an application for this scale for hundreds of potential visitor accommodation units, you haven't done a lot in terms of analysis compared with, say, a resource consent to apply for those sorts of activities. But are we to take from your evidence that there's plenty of room, there are options around, and we're just to be happy, we're to be satisfied that it'll all sort itself out in time?
Short answer, yes. From an engineering point of view,
let's take it from you. The
engineering often find is the least issues. There's always solutions that can be achieved. With the existing water that Corbridge already has, they have a source of water, they have room to treat wastewater. They're looking at innovative means to reuse water from wastewater as well. Really, the engineering aspect is solvable. Has been.
I mean, we can't rely on it being connected to the council services because they say it's not planned for, it's not funded.
Well,
and maybe it'll happen, but what I'm saying is when you create a zone with this level of development being permitted within it, I think the policies of the plan say that we need to be satisfied that it can be serviced. So really you're saying that even whether or not it can connect to the public services, they can all be provided readily, and even in this case of water, are available already on site.
Yes, up to 1,200 units at the moment. So
up to 1,200 units?
For water.
Because that's what you've calculated for the water supply?
Yes. Yeah.
Also
remember with council infrastructure, obviously they've modelled all existing zones and they have a reasonable idea of what's going on. Whenever we apply for something like this, the first thing is always computer says no. They type in, say no, we've got no ability. It's not planned for. It's just not going to happen. I'll be interested to explore further with council about what capacity they've allowed for the Wanaka Airport. If that's not going ahead, well then there's potential changes there, and there may actually be capacity allowed for that could accommodate part or all of this. Really, the zoning goes through, and we can demonstrate we've got a private means to service it, which I feel that we have. It's as much need to go to council and say, ideally, if we want to get rid of our wastewater without having to treat it on site, do you have capacity use or no? And here are the exact numbers. We don't have the exact numbers because the detailed design of Corbridge hasn't been totally confirmed yet. The size of the hotel is unknown. We have some numbers around some of the fairway side dwellings. So we have a minimum number, I guess, but at this stage, I can only work backwards from what water they have to give you, to say how many we could service theoretically. Not saying that it's going to be 1,200 there, it may be only half that.
But we can only work on the basis of the provisions in the plan.
Mm.
And they're especially in the high density
quite
areas,
they're
very open.
Yeah.
There are some limitations on fairway visitor accommodation numbers. But even there in the hundreds.
Well, what's going to limit the development then will be its serviceability in terms of how many numbers.
Can I just interrupt? I might circumvent this a little because there's actually
a rule in the general provisions that apply to Albridge that requires a controlled activity consent for any building, and one of the factors of control is servicing.
Yes, but we know the limitation of controlled activities.
Well, it means it has to be granted, sure.
Yes.
But you can impose conditions around servicing, so we'll need to demonstrate at the time of consent that the services can be put in place.
Yes, so that really takes us back to the argument. How much do we need to demonstrate at the time of zoning that the services will realistically and physically and fundability be able to be provided when it's either permitted or controlled from then on for hundreds of units? And it seems Mr. Botting's evidence on the face of it seems pretty slim for a development of this scale to give us the confidence that it'll all be provided, especially in the face of a council that's not sort of saying it's going to be able to be connected publicly.
I think that just speaks to perhaps the confidence we have that there are solutions available, and the overarching model that Corbridge is wanting to roll out here, which Mr. Marshall spoke to.
But that's
Watkins
not in the rules, is it? There's nothing about sustainable wastewater disposal in the provisions.
No, that's right.
So, I don't want to dismiss it because I understand it, and I don't want to say it's not a fantastic vision, but for us, we have to look at the provisions.
Yeah. If we can't deliver the servicing, we're not going to be able to build things.
Well, I can see you coming along and arguing what's controlled activity, permitted activities, you know, we'll just cobble together some sort of servicing here and another lot over there, and it's an easy argument later on.
But if I suppose I'm not quite sure. The key is that the services are provided, and how that is ultimately delivered, yes, we don't know the answer to that yet, but I suppose I'm not entirely sure that you need to know the exact detail of that yet. The question is, can it be serviced? And I think the answer that we're giving you is yes, it can. It's an engineering solution, a problem at the end of the day. There's always a solution to that, and we will have to deliver it.
So that's where I came back to. Basically, we're relying on Mr. Botting saying, yes, there's a solution, it's easy, don't worry about the detail, that can be sorted out later.
Yes.
Thank you.
But I think the point I want to make is there is a consent regime that we will have to go through to demonstrate that we can do that.
This is the controlled activity.
Yeah, so there'll be
regime.
Potentially conditions that could be put in place around establishing the servicing for the buildings at the time that we apply for consent for them.
Okay. But what you couldn't do is require as a condition precedent services be provided before any building occurred. That wouldn't be a valid condition, would it?
No.
Well, I think in essence the timing of that provision, I don't think you could require services beyond what was being applied for at that time. So say if we're applying for 25 fairway accommodation units.
With septic tanks.
Well, yes. I mean, that is a possibility, I suppose. I mean, we've got, if you look at the densities within some of those areas, that could be an option. And I don't think that's necessarily problematic. So I think, in terms of the condition precedent, I think if we're applying for 25 units, I don't think you could put in place a condition precedent that said you need to put in place servicing for 50 units. But you would certainly be able to condition that the servicing of those 25 units was in place.
That'll do for me.
Nothing further for me, thank you.
Just one, if I may. Like any good engineer, you'll sit there and tell me it can all be done, just how much money are we going to throw at it?
It's usually the way.
Yep. Question with regard to dissenting regimes after the Havelock North incident and potential for private schemes, be it supply or disposal. Are you, I mean, that's again, it's, there could be under that specific requirement, could be, to connect, could there not? And that's a question I'm just asking in general in terms of an engineering connection.
Well, we obviously have to meet the water quality standards, I mean supply standards, for water quality and for monitoring. And for a scheme like Corbridge, with its size, we have to be registered, similar to, I guess, to a, perhaps Cadrona Ski Field, which, you know, have registered suppliers and requirements to monitor and ensure that their water that they provide for their clients is suitable for drinking. There'll be an expectation and a requirement that it'll be the same for Corbridge. So the mechanisms in place to ensure that water is safe.
I'm not 100% sure Cadrona Ski Field is the best example.
No. Obviously, they have issues with their wastewater up there in a particularly difficult environment. It'd be cold to have a wastewater system operate at those levels.
It's more the traversing that the government has highlighted the private schemes, essentially. I mean, there's always a solution. I don't know if a long drop, for example, would be a positive solution in a five-star hotel. There's always a solution.
But maybe composting toilets.
Yeah, really. But the government regime has highlighted that essentially private, or that the way they're going is private schemes are next cab off the rank. They'll deal with council schemes, and that'll happen in the next short term. In the medium term, private schemes will be the next target. So it's just awareness of that, and if this, I mean, obviously.
Well, it obviously has far wide implications for council throughout the entire country. There's, you know, obviously use Jack's Point as an example. Is there a need that then council perhaps doesn't own it but takes over the management of it? Options for Corbridge would be to engage council's own contractors to manage their water.
Just a solution.
Yeah.
Good thought. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Could you provide us with the water supply consent?
Yes, yeah, I can find those and email those through. Yep.
So, I suggest, Ms. Elder, you just do that when you come back to me with by the end of next week.
Not a problem. Are you wanting all of them or just the board consent?
Well, any that you might be relying on.
So I think they'll be the test. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bobbitt.
Thank you.
We'll take the lunch adjournment. Back, say, 1:15.
That's good.